Halfway to the front door, Lievin heard a familiar sound of coughing in the hall. But the noise of his own footsteps prevented his hearing it clearly, and he hoped he was mistaken. Then he saw the whole of his brother's long, bony, familiar figure, and it seemed that there could be no mistake. But he still hoped he was mistaken, and that this tall man who was taking off his overcoat and coughing was not his brother Nikolai. Lievin was fond of his brother, but to be with him was always a torment. Under the sway of the thoughts that had come to him and of Agafya Mikhailovna's reminders, he was in an unsettled and confused state of mind, and the forthcoming meeting with his brother seemed particularly distressing. Instead of a cheerful, healthy stranger, who he hoped would have diverted him from his mental perplexity, he had to meet his brother, who knew him through and through and would disturb his innermost thoughts and force him to make a clean breast of everything. And that was what he did not desire. Angry with himself for this bad feeling, Lievin ran into the hall. And as soon as he had a near view of his brother, this feeling of disappointment vanished and was replaced by pity. Dreadful as his emaciation and illness had previously made Nikolai, he was now still thinner and weaker. He was a mere skeleton, covered with skin. He stood in the hall, jerking his long, thin neck, drawing a scarf from it, and smiling in a strangely piteous manner. When he saw this meek, submissive smile, Lievin felt his throat contract convulsively.
"Ah, I have come to see you," said Nikolai, in a hollow voice, without taking his eyes for an instant from his brother's face. "I have long wanted to, but did not feel well. Now I am much better."
And he wiped his beard with the thin palms of his hands.
"Yes, yes,"
answered Lievin. He was still more terrified when, kissing his brother's face, his lips felt the dryness of the skin, and he saw his large, strangely brilliant eyes close at hand. Some weeks before this, Konstantin Lievin had written to tell his brother that, after the sale of a few things which till then had remained undivided, Nikolai was entitled to his share, which came to about 2,000 rubles. Nikolai said that he had now come to fetch that money, but chiefly to visit his own nest and touch his native soil, in order, like the heroes of old, to gather strength from it for the work that lay before him. In spite of the fact that he was more round-shouldered than ever, and that, being so tall, his leanness was startling, his movements were quick and sudden as formerly. Lievin took him to his room. Nikolai dressed carefully, a thing he never used to do, brushed his thin, straight hair, and went smiling upstairs. He was in a most affectionate and cheerful mood, such as Lievin remembered his often being in as a child, and he even mentioned Sergei Ivanich without irritation. When he met Agafya Mikhailovna, he joked with her and questioned her about the other old servants. The news of Parfyon Denisich's death affected him strangely. A look of fear appeared on his face, but he immediately recovered himself.
"After all, he was old,"
he remarked, and changed the subject.
"Well, I will spend a month or two with you, and then I will go to Moscow. You know, Miakov has promised me a post, and I'm entering the civil service. I will now arrange my life quite differently," he continued. "You know, I've got rid of that woman."
"Maria Nikolaevna? Why? What for?"
"Oh, she was a horrid woman. She's caused me a lot of unpleasantness."
But he did not say in what the unpleasantness consisted. He could not explain that he had turned Maria Nikolaevna away because she made his tea too weak, and chiefly because she waited on him as on an invalid.
"Besides, I want to alter my life completely. Of course, like everybody else, I have done stupid things, but property is the least consideration, and I don't regret mine. Health is the great thing, and my health, thank God, has improved."
Lievin listened, trying but unable to think of what to say. Nikolai probably felt the same. He began questioning his brother about his affairs, and Lievin was glad to talk about himself because he could do so without any pretense. He told Nikolai of his plans and activities. Nikolai listened, but evidently was not interested. These two men were so near akin and so intimate with one another that between them the least movement or intonation expressed more than could be said in words. At present the same thought filled both their minds and dominated all else: Nikolai's illness and approaching death. But neither of them dared speak of it, and not having expressed the one thing that occupied their thoughts, whatever they said rang false. Never before had Lievin felt so glad when an evening was over and it was time to go to bed. Never had he been so unnatural and artificial, even with an outsider, or when making a formal call, as he was that day. And his consciousness of this artificiality and his repentance made him more unnatural. He wished to weep over his dear, dying brother, but had to listen and keep up a conversation about how Nikolai was going to live. The house being damp and only his bedroom heated, Lievin put his brother to sleep behind a partition in that room. Nikolai went to bed, but, whether he slept or not, kept tossing and coughing like a sick man and, when unable to clear his throat, muttering some complaint. Sometimes he sighed deeply and said, "Oh my God!" Sometimes, when the phlegm choked him, he muttered angrily, "Oh, come on!" Lievin long lay awake, listening to him. His thoughts were very various, but they all led up to death. Death, the inevitable end of everything, confronted him for the first time with irresistible force. And that death which was present in this dear brother, who, waking up, moaned and by habit called indiscriminately on God and on the devil, was not so far away as it had hitherto seemed to be. It was within himself, too. He felt it. If not today, then tomorrow, or 30 years hence, was it not all the same? But what that inevitable death was, he not only did not know, not only had never considered, but could not and dared not consider. "I am working. I want to do something." And I had forgotten that it will all end in death. He sat on his bed in the dark, doubled his arms round his knees and thought, scarcely breathing from the mental strain. But the more mental effort he made, the clearer he saw that it was undoubtedly so, that he had really forgotten and overlooked one little circumstance in life: that death would come and end everything, so that it was useless to begin anything, and that there was no help for it. Yes, it was terrible, but true. "But I am still alive. What am I to do now? What am I to do?" he said, despairingly. He lit a candle, got up carefully, went to the looking-glass, and began examining his face and hair. Yes, there were grey hairs on his temples. He opened his mouth. His double teeth were beginning to decay. He bared his muscular arms. Yes, he was very strong. But Nikolai, who was breathing there with the remains of his lungs, had once had a healthy body too. And he suddenly remembered how, as children, they used to go to bed together and only waited till Theodor Bogdanich had left the room to throw pillows at one another and laugh so irrepressibly that even the fear of Theodor Bogdanich could not stop that overflowing, bubbling consciousness of the joy of living. And now that sunken, hollow chest. And I, who do not know what will happen to me, or why.
"Oh, the devil! What are you fidgeting for? Why don't you sleep?"
his brother's voice called to him. "Oh, I don't know, just sleeplessness."
"And I have slept well. I don't perspire now, see? Feel my shirt. It's not damp."
Lievin felt it, returned behind the partition and put out the candle, but was long unable to sleep. Just when the question of how to live had become a little clearer to him, a new insoluble problem presented itself. Death. Well, he is dying. He will die before spring. How can he be helped? What can I say to him? What do I know about it?
I had forgotten there was such a thing.
Chapter 32. Lievin had long ago noticed that after people have made one uncomfortable by their pliancy and submissiveness, they soon become unbearably exacting and aggressive. He felt that this would happen with his brother. And really, Nikolai's meekness did not last long. The very next morning he grew irritable and cavilled at everything his brother said, touching his most sensitive spots. Lievin felt guilty, but could do nothing. He felt that if they both spoke without dissimulation and straight from the heart, they would only look into one another's eyes, and Konstantin would say nothing but, "You will die, you will die," and Nikolai would only say in reply, "I know I shall die, and I am afraid, afraid, afraid." That was all they would say if only they spoke straight from the heart. But that would make life impossible. Therefore, Konstantin tried to do what all his life he had tried and never known how to do, although he had often observed that many people were able to do it well, something without which life was impossible. He tried to say something different from what he thought, and he felt all the time that it sounded false and that his brother detected him and grew irritable. On the third day of his stay, Nikolai challenged his brother to explain his plans to him once more, and not only found fault with them, but purposely confused them with communism.
"You have only taken an idea from others and distorted it, and you wish to apply it where it is inapplicable."
"But I tell you that the two things have nothing in common. Communists deny the justice of property, capital, or inheritance, while I do not deny that main stimulus." It was repulsive to Lievin to find himself using such words, but since he had been engrossed in his work, he had involuntarily begun using more and more foreign words. "But want only to regulate labour."
"That is it. You have taken other people's idea, dropped all that gave it force, and wish to make one believe that it is something new," said Nikolai, angrily jerking his neck. "But my idea has nothing in common, that idea," said Nikolai Lievin with a sarcastic smile and angrily glistening eyes. "That idea, at any rate, if one may say so, has a geometric charm of definiteness and certainty. It may be utopian, but granting the possibility of making a tabula rasa of the past and abolishing private property and families, then labour comes by its own. But you have nothing."
"Why do you muddle it? I never was a communist."
"But I have been, and now I think it is premature but reasonable, and that it has a future as Christianity had in the first centuries."
"I only think that the force of labour must be dealt with in a scientifically experimental manner. It must be studied, and its characteristics..."
"But that is quite unnecessary. That force finds its own form of activity in accord with its degree of development. There used to be slaves everywhere, then villeins, and we have labour paid in kind, and leaseholders, and hired labour. So what are you looking for?"
At these words, Lievin suddenly grew warm, for at the bottom of his heart he felt that it was true. True that he wished to balance between communism and the existing forms of life, and that this was hardly possible.
"I am seeking for a way of making labour profitable for me and for the labourers," he answered hotly. "I want to establish..." "You do not want to establish anything. You simply want to be original, as you always have done, and to show that you're not just exploiting the peasants, but have ideas."
"You think so?"
"Well, then, leave me alone," said Lievin,
and he felt that a muscle was uncontrollably quivering in his left cheek.
"You have no convictions and never had any. You only want to flatter your self-esteem."
"Well, all right, but leave me alone."
"I will, and high time, too. You can go to the devil, and I'm sorry I came."
However much Levin tried afterwards to pacify his brother, Nikolai would not listen to it, but said that it was much better for them to part. And Levin saw that life had become simply intolerable for his brother. Nikolai had quite made up his mind to go. Konstantin came to him again, and in an unnatural manner asked his forgiveness if he had offended him in any way.
"Ah, this is magnanimity," said Nikolai, and smiled. "If you wish to be in the right, I can let you have that pleasure. You are in the right. But all the same, I shall go away."
Only just before he left, Nikolai kissed Konstantin, and suddenly said with a strange and serious look at his brother,
"Do not think too badly of me, Kostya."
And his voice trembled. These were the only sincere words that had passed between them. Levin understood that they were meant to say, "You see that I'm in a bad way, and perhaps we shall not meet again." He understood this, and tears trembled in his eyes. He again kissed his brother, but he did not know what to answer. 3 days after his brother's departure, Levin left for abroad. He surprised young Shcherbatsky, Kitty's cousin, whom he happened to meet at a railway station, by his moroseness. "What is the matter with you?" asked Shcherbatsky.
"Nothing much, but there is little to be happy about in this world."
"Little? You'd better come to Paris with me, instead of going to some Mulhausen or other. You'll see how jolly it'll be."
"No, I have done with that. It is time for me to die."
"That is a fine thing," said Shcherbatsky, laughing. "I am only preparing to begin to live."
"Yes, I thought so too, till lately. But now I know that I shall soon die."
Levin was saying what of late he had really been thinking. He saw death and the approach of death in everything. But the work he had begun interested him all the more. After all, he had to live his life somehow till death came. Everything for him was wrapped in darkness. But just because of the darkness, feeling his work to be the only thread to guide him through that darkness, he seized upon it and clung to it with all his might. Part 4. Chapter 1. The Karenins, husband and wife, continued to live in the same house and to meet daily, but they were wholly estranged. Karenin made it a rule to see his wife every day, so as not to give the servants any grounds for making conjectures, but he avoided dining at home. Vronsky never came to the Karenins' house, but Anna met him elsewhere, and her husband knew it. The situation was a torment to all three, and not one of them could have stood it for a single day but for the hope that it would change, and that the whole matter was only a temporary, though painful, trial. Karenin expected the passion to pass, as everything passes. All would be forgotten, and his name not dishonoured. Anna, who was responsible for the situation, and for whom, among the three, it was most painful, bore it because she not only expected, but felt sure, that very soon everything would be settled and cleared up. She had not the least idea what would settle it, but was quite certain that it would now come very soon. Involuntarily submitting to her judgment, Vronsky too expected something, not dependent on him, to clear up all these difficulties. In the middle of the winter, he spent a very dull week. He had been chosen to act as guide to a foreign prince, and was obliged to show him the sights of Petersburg. Vronsky had a distinguished appearance, possessed the art of carrying himself with respectful dignity, and was in the habit of associating with people of that class. That was why he was chosen to attend the prince. But the task seemed a hard one to him. The prince did not want to miss seeing anything about which he might be questioned at home, and he also wanted to enjoy as many Russian amusements as possible, and Vronsky was obliged to accompany him in both cases. In the mornings they went sightseeing, and in the evenings took part in the national amusements. The prince enjoyed unusually good health, even for a prince, and by means of gymnastics and care of his body had developed his strength to such a degree that, in spite of the excess he indulged in when amusing himself, he looked as fresh as a big, green, shining cucumber. He had travelled a great deal, and considered that one of the chief advantages of the present convenient ways of communication was the easy access they afforded to national amusements. He had been to Spain, where he arranged serenades and became intimate with a Spanish woman who played the mandolin. In Switzerland, he had shot a chamois. In England, he had jumped hedges in a pink coat and shot 200 pheasants for a bet. He'd been in a harem in Turkey, ridden an elephant in India, and now, in Russia, he wanted a taste of distinctive Russian amusements. Vronsky, who was, so to say, the prince's chief master of ceremonies, had great difficulty in organizing all the Russian amusements offered to the prince by various people: trotting races, pancakes, bear hunting, and drives in three-horse sledges, gypsies and Russian sprees with smashing of crockery. And the prince imbibed the Russian spirit with the greatest ease, smashed trays full of crockery, made gypsy girls sit on his lap, and yet seemed to be always asking, "What next? Is this the whole of the Russian spirit?" But on the whole, of all the Russian amusements, the prince liked the French actresses, a ballet girl, and white seal champagne best. Vronsky was used to princes, but whether it was that he himself had lately changed, or whether his intimacy with this prince was too close, that week, at any rate, appeared very wearisome to him. All that week he felt like a man attending a lunatic, and afraid for his own reason, too. He was obliged to be on his guard the whole time, not to deviate from the path of severe official respect for fear of being insulted. The prince's manner toward the very people who, to Vronsky's astonishment, were ready to go through fire and water to provide Russian amusements for him, was contemptuous. His opinion of Russian women, whom he wanted to study, more than once made Vronsky flush with indignation. But the chief reason why the prince's presence oppressed Vronsky was that he saw himself reflected in the prince, and what he saw in that mirror was not flattering to his vanity. The prince was a very stupid, very healthy, and very cleanly man, and nothing more. He was a gentleman, it is true, and Vronsky could not deny it. He was quiet and not cringing with those above him, free and simple with his equals, and contemptuously good-natured with his inferiors. Vronsky was the same, and considered it very meritorious to be so. But in his relations with the prince, he was the inferior, and felt indignant with that condescendingly good-natured treatment. "Stupid ox! Can I really be like that myself?" he thought. However this may have been, he parted from the prince, who went on to Moscow, and received his thanks. Vronsky was very pleased to be rid of the embarrassing situation and the unpleasant mirror. He took leave of him at the railway station on the seventh day, on returning from a bear hunt, after which there had been demonstrations of Russian prowess all night. Chapter 2. On returning home, Vronsky found a note from Anna awaiting him. She wrote, "I am ill and unhappy. I cannot go out, neither can I go on any longer without seeing you. Come this evening. Alexei Alexandrovich is going to the council and will remain there till 10. After wondering for a moment at the strangeness of her asking him straight out to come to her house in spite of her husband's injunctions, he decided to go. He had that winter been promoted to the rank of colonel, had left the regiment, and was living alone. Immediately after lunch he lay down on the sofa. 5 minutes later the memory of the disreputable scenes at which he had been present during the last few days became jumbled and connected with pictures of Anna and a peasant who had played an important part as a beater at the bear hunting. And Vronsky fell asleep. He woke up in the dark, trembling with fear, and hurriedly lit a candle. "What has happened? What horrors I dreamt! Yes, yes, the peasant, the beater, I think he was small and dirty, with a tangled beard, was stooping down and doing something or other, and suddenly began to say strange words in French. That is all there was in that dream," he thought. "But why did it seem so terrible?" He vividly recalled the peasant and the incomprehensible words that the man had uttered, and a shudder of terror ran down his back. "What nonsense," he thought, glancing at his watch. It was already 8:30. He rang for his valet, dressed hurriedly, and went out into the porch, having quite forgotten his dream and feeling worried only by the fact that he was late. As he drove up to the Karenins' porch, he again glanced at his watch and saw that it was 9:10. A high, narrow brougham with a pair of grey horses stood before the front door. "She was coming to me," thought Vronsky. "That would have been better. It is unpleasant for me to enter this house." "But no matter, I cannot hide," he thought. And with the manner habitual to him since childhood of one who has nothing to be ashamed of, Vronsky got out of his sledge and went to the door. The door opened, and the hall porter, with a rug over his arm, called to the coachman. Vronsky, though not in the habit of noticing details, noticed the look of surprise on the man's face. In the doorway, he nearly knocked up against Karenin. The gaslight lit up Karenin's worn, bloodless face beneath the black hat, and his white tie showing from beneath the beaver collar of his overcoat. His dull, expressionless eyes were fixed on Vronsky's face. Vronsky bowed, and Karenin silently moved his lips, lifted his hand to his hat, and went out. Vronsky saw him get into the carriage without looking round, take the rug and a pair of opera glasses through the carriage window. Then he disappeared in the darkness. Vronsky entered the hall. His brows were knit, and his eyes shone with a proud, angry light. "That is a nice position," he thought. "If he struggled, if he defended his honour, I could act and could express my feelings. But this weakness or meanness, he puts me in the position of an impostor, which I did not and do not mean to be." Since the explanation with Anna in the Vreda Gardens, Vronsky's ideas had changed. Involuntarily submitting to Anna's weakness, who, ready in advance to accept anything, gave herself up to him entirely and expected him to decide her fate, he had long ceased to imagine that their union could end in the way he had then expected. His ambitious plans had receded to the background, and feeling that he had come out of the range of activity in which everything was definite, he completely gave himself up to his passion, and that passion bound him closer and closer to her. While still in the hall, he heard her retreating footsteps, and knew that she had been waiting and listening for him, but had now gone back to the drawing-room. "No!" she cried when she saw him, and at the first sound of her voice, tears filled her eyes. "No! If things go on like this for long, it will happen much, much sooner."
"What, my dear?"
"What? I wait in torment 1 hour, 2 hours. No, no, I won't. I cannot quarrel with you. I expect you could not help it. No, I won't."
She put both her hands on his shoulders and gazed at him long with a deep look of ecstasy, and yet searchingly. She scrutinized his face to make up for the time she had not seen him. She compared, as she did at every interview with him, the image her fancy painted of him, incomparably finer than and impossible in actual existence, with his real self.
Chapter 3. "You met him?" she asked when they sat down at a table under the lamp. "That is your punishment for being late."
"Yes, but how did it happen? He had to be at the council."
"He had been and had come back, and afterwards went somewhere else. But never mind. Don't speak about it. Where have you been? With the prince all the time?"
She knew all the details of his life. He wished to say that he had been up all night and had fallen asleep, but seeing her excited and happy face, he felt ashamed. So he said that he had to go and report the prince's departure.
"But now that is all over? He is gone?"
"Yes, thank heaven, that is all over. You would hardly believe how intolerable it was."
"Why? Is it not the kind of life all you young men lead?" she said, frowning. And taking up her crochet work from the table, began disentangling the hook without looking at Vronsky.
I have long since abandoned that kind of life, he said, wondering at the change in her face and trying to penetrate its meaning. And I must own, he went on, smiling and showing his compact row of teeth, that I seem to have been looking in a mirror the whole of this week while watching that kind of life, and it was very unpleasant. She held her work in her hands, without crocheting, gazing at him with a strange, glittering, unfriendly look. Lisa called on me this morning. They still visit me, in spite of the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, she said. And she told me about your Athenian party. How disgusting. I was only going to say that, she interrupted him. It was Thérèse, whom you knew before? I was going to say how horrid you men are. How is it that you can forget that a woman cannot forget these things, she said, getting more and more heated, and thereby betraying the cause of her irritation. Especially a woman who cannot know your life. What do I know? What did I know? Only what you tell me. And what proof have I that you tell me the truth? Anna, you hurt me. Don't you believe me? Have I not told you that I have not a thought that I would hide from you? Yes, yes, she said, evidently trying to drive away her jealous thoughts. But if you only knew how hard it is for me. I believe you, I do believe you. Well, what were you going to say? But he could not at once remember what he had wished to say. These fits of jealousy, which had lately begun to repeat themselves more and more frequently, horrified him, and however much he tried to hide the fact, they made him feel colder toward her, although he knew that the jealousy was caused by love for him. How often he had told himself that to be loved by her was happiness, and now that she loved him as only a woman can, for whom love outweighs all else that is good in life, he was much further from happiness than when he had followed her from Moscow. Then he thought himself unhappy, but happiness was all in the future. Now he felt that the best happiness was already in the past. She was not at all such as he had first seen her. Both morally and physically she had changed for the worse. She had broadened out, and as she spoke of the actress, there was a malevolent look on her face which distorted its expression. He looked at her as a man might look at a faded flower he had plucked, in which it was difficult for him to trace the beauty that had made him pick and so destroy it. Yet in spite of this, he felt that though at first, while his love was strong, he would have been able, had he earnestly desired it, to pull that love out of his heart, yet now, when he imagined, as he did at that moment, that he felt no love for her, he knew that the bond between them could not be broken. Well, what were you going to tell me about the prince? I have driven away the demon, she added. They spoke of jealousy as the demon. Yes, what had you begun telling me about the prince? What was it you found so hard to bear? Oh, it was intolerable, he said, trying to pick up the lost thread of what he had in his mind. He does not improve on nearer acquaintance. If I am to describe him, he is a finely bred animal, like those that get prizes at cattle shows, and nothing more, he concluded in a tone of vexation which awoke her interest. Oh, but in what way? She rejoined. Anyhow, he must have seen much, and is well educated. It is quite a different kind of education, that education of theirs. One can see that he's been educated only to have the right to despise education, as they despise everything except animal pleasures. But don't all of you like those animal pleasures? She remarked, and he again noticed on her face that dismal look which evaded his. Why do you take his part so? He said, smiling. I don't take his part, and it is a matter of complete indifference to me. But I should say that as you did not like these pleasures, you might have declined to go. But it gives you pleasure to see Thérèse dressed as Eve. Again, the demon, said Vronsky, taking the hand which she had put on the table and kissing it. Yes, but I can't help it. You don't know how I've suffered while waiting for you. I don't think I have a jealous nature. I am not jealous. I trust you when you are here, near me. But when you are away, living your life, which I don't understand, She turned away from him, and managing at last to disentangle her hook with the aid of her forefinger, began to draw the stitches of white wool shining in the lamplight through each other, the delicate wrist moving rapidly and nervously within her embroidered cuff.
"Well, and what happened? Where did you meet Alexei Alexandrovich?" she suddenly asked, her voice ringing unnaturally.
"I knocked up against him in the doorway."
"And he bowed, like this, to you?"
She drew up her face, half closed her eyes, and quickly changed the expression of her face, folding her hands. And Vronsky saw at once upon her beautiful face the very look with which Karenin had bowed to him. He smiled, and she laughed merrily, with that delightful laughter from the chest which was one of her special charms.
"I can't at all understand him," said Vronsky. "Had he, after your explanation in the country, broken with you, had he challenged me, yes. But this sort of thing I do not understand. How can he put up with such a position? He suffers, that is evident."
"He," she said sarcastically, "he is perfectly contented."
"Why are we all tormenting each other when everything might be so comfortable?"
"Oh, but not he. As if I did not know him and the falsehood with which he is saturated. As if it were possible for anyone to live as he is living with me. He understands and feels nothing. Could a man who has any feelings live in the same house with his guilty wife? Could he talk to her and call her by her Christian name?"
And without meaning to, she again mimicked him.
"Ma chère Anna, my dear."
"He is not a man, not a human being. He is a doll.
No one else knows it, but I do. Oh, if I were he, I should long since have killed, have torn in pieces a wife such as I, and not have called her ma chère Anna. He is not a man, but an official machine. He does not understand that I am your wife, that he is a stranger, a superfluous... Oh, but don't let us talk about him."
"You are unjust, unjust, my dear," said Vronsky, trying to pacify her. "But still, don't let us talk about him. Tell me what you've been doing.
What is the matter with you? What is that illness of yours? What does the doctor say?"
She looked at him with quizzical joy. She had evidently remembered other comical and unpleasant sides of her husband's character and waited for an opportunity to mention them. He continued,
"I expect it is not illness at all, but only your condition. When is it to be?"
The mocking light in her eyes faded, but a smile of a different kind, the knowledge of something unknown to him and gentle sadness, replaced the former expression of her face.
"Soon. Soon. You were saying that our position was full of torment and should be put an end to. If you only knew how hard it is on me, what would I not give to be able to love you freely and boldly? I should not be tortured. I would not torment you with my jealousy. It will happen soon. But not in the way you think."
And at the thought of how it was going to happen, she felt so sorry for herself that the tears came into her eyes and she could not continue. She laid her hand, sparkling with rings and the whiteness of the skin, on his sleeve. "It will not happen as we think. I did not want to tell you, but you make me do it. Soon, very soon, everything will get disentangled and we shall be able to rest and not torment each other any more." "I do not understand," he said, though he did understand. "You are asking when?"
"Soon, and I shall not survive it. Don't interrupt," she said hurriedly. "I shall die, and I am very glad that I shall die. I shall find deliverance and deliver you."
The tears ran down her cheeks. He stooped over her hand and began kissing it, trying to hide the emotion which he knew to be groundless but could not master.
"That is right,"
That is better, she said, firmly pressing his hand. This is all. All that remains to us.
He recovered and lifted his head.
What rubbish! What senseless rubbish you are talking!
No, it is not. It is true.
What is true?
That I am going to die. I have had a dream.
A dream?
Vronsky instantly remembered the peasant of his dream. Yes, a dream, she said. I dreamt it a long time ago. I thought I had run into my bedroom, that I had to fetch or find out something there. You know how it happens in dreams. And her eyes dilated with horror. And in the bedroom, there was something standing in the corner.
Oh, what nonsense! How can one believe?
But she would not allow him to stop her. What she was saying was of too much importance to her. And that something turned round. And I saw it was a peasant with a rough beard, small and dreadful. I wanted to run away, but he stooped over a sack and was fumbling about in it. She showed how he fumbled in the sack. Her face was full of horror, and Vronsky, remembering his dream, felt the same horror filling his soul. He fumbles about and mutters French words so quickly, and with a burr, you know, il faut le battre, le faire, le broyer, le pétrir. And in my horror, I tried to wake, but I woke still in a dream and began asking myself what it could mean. And Corneille says to me, you will die in childbed, ma'am.
Then I woke. What nonsense. What nonsense, said Vronsky.
But he felt that there was no conviction in his voice. Well, don't let us talk about it. Ring the bell, I will order tea.
But wait, it won't be long, and I...
But suddenly she stopped. The expression of her face changed instantaneously. The horror and agitation were replaced by an expression of quiet, serious, and blissful attention. He could not understand the meaning of this change. She had felt a new life quickening within her. Chapter 4. Karenin, after meeting Vronsky in his own porch, went on, as had been his intention, to the Italian opera. He sat through the first two acts and saw everybody that it was necessary for him to see. On his return home, he carefully looked at the coat stand, and noticing that no military coat hung there, he went to his study as usual. Contrary to his habit, however, he did not go to bed, but walked up and down the room till 3 in the morning. The feeling of anger with his wife, who would not observe the rules of propriety and fulfil the only condition he had insisted on, that is, that she should not see her lover in his house, gave him no rest. She had not fulfilled his condition, and he was obliged to punish her and carry out his threat, to divorce her and take away her son. He knew the difficulties connected with such a step, but he had said he would do it and was now obliged to do it. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna had hinted to him that that was the best way to get out of the situation, and he knew that of late the practice of divorce had been brought to such a state of perfection that he saw a possibility of overcoming the formal difficulties. Besides, misfortunes never come singly, and the affair of the subject races and the irrigation of the Zaraisk province had caused Karenin so much unpleasantness in his official capacity that he had of late felt extremely irritable. He did not sleep at all, and his wrath, increasing in a kind of gigantic progression, had reached its utmost limits by the morning. He dressed in haste, and as if he were carrying a cup
brimful of wrath and were afraid of spilling any and of losing with his anger the energy he needed for an explanation with his wife, he went to her room as soon as he knew that she was up. Anna, who thought that she knew her husband so well, was struck by his appearance when he entered. His brow was knit, and his eyes, gloomily fixed before him, avoided looking at her. His lips were firmly and contemptuously closed. In his step, his movements, and the sound of his voice was such determination and firmness as his wife had never known in him. He entered her boudoir, and without saying good morning, went straight to her writing table, took up her keys, and opened the drawer. "What do you want?" she exclaimed. "Your lover's letters." "They're not there," she said, closing the drawer. But this action proved to him that he had guessed rightly, and rudely pushing away her hand, he quickly drew out a letter case in which he knew that she kept her most important papers. She wished to snatch away the letter case, but he thrust her aside. "Sit down. I must speak to you," he said, taking the letter case under his arm and pressing it so tight with his elbow that his shoulder went up. Astonished and abashed, she silently looked at him. "I told you that I would not allow you to see your lover here."
"I wanted to see him in order—" She paused, unable to invent a reason.
"I do not go into particulars of why a woman wants to see her lover."
I only wanted,
she said, flushing. His coarseness irritated her and gave her boldness.
"Is it possible you do not feel how easy it is for you to insult me?" she said.
"It is possible to insult an honest man or an honest woman, but to tell a thief that he is a thief is only la constatation d'un fait."
"I have not seen this new trait of cruelty in you before."
"You call it cruelty when a husband gives his wife complete freedom while he affords her honourable shelter on the one condition that she should observe the laws of propriety? Is that cruelty?"
"It is worse than cruelty. It is baseness, if you want to know,"
Anna exclaimed in a burst of anger and rose to go.
"No!"
he shouted in his squeaky voice, which now rose to a higher note than usual, and seizing her so tightly by the wrists with his large fingers that the bracelet he pressed left red marks, he forced her back into her seat.
"Baseness?
Since you wish to use that word, it is baseness to abandon a husband and a son for a lover and to go on eating the husband's bread."
Her head dropped. She did not say what she had said to her lover the day before, that Vronsky was her real husband and that he, Karenin, was superfluous. She did not even think it. She felt all the justice of his words and only said softly,
"You cannot describe my position as being worse than I know it to be.
But why do you tell me all this?"
"Why do I tell you? Why?"
he went on, just as angrily. "That you should know that, as you have not fulfilled my wish that propriety should be observed, I shall take steps to put an end to this situation."
"Soon, very soon, it will come to an end of itself,"
she muttered. And at the thought of the nearness of death which she now desired, tears again filled her eyes.
"It will end sooner than you and your lover imagine. You want to satisfy animal passions, Alexei Alexandrovich. This is not only ungenerous, but not even gentlemanly, to hit one who is down." "That's all very well, but you think only of yourself. The sufferings of the man who was your husband do not interest you. What do you care that his whole life is wrecked and how much he has suffered?
Karenin was speaking so rapidly that he blundered and could not pronounce the word, and at last said "suffered." That struck her as funny. But immediately after, she felt ashamed that anything could seem funny to her at such a moment. And for the first time, she felt for him and put herself for an instant in his place and was sorry for him. But what could she say or do? She bowed her head in silence. He too was silent for a while, and then again began in a less squeaky voice, coldly emphasizing certain chance words that had no special importance.
"I came to tell you," said he.
She looked up at him. No, it was an illusion, she thought, calling to mind the expression of his face when he blundered over the word "suffled." No, as if a man with those dull eyes and that self-satisfied immobility could feel.
"I cannot change anything,"
she whispered.
"I have come to tell you that I am going to Moscow tomorrow, and shall not return to this house again, and that you will hear my decision through the lawyer whom I shall employ in the divorce suit.
My son will stay with my sister," said Karenin, making an effort to remember what he had wanted to say about his son. "You want Seretse in order to hurt me," she said, looking at him from under her brows. "You do not care for him. Leave me, Seretse." "Yes, I have even lost my affection for my son, because he is connected with my repulsion for you. But all the same, I shall take him away. Goodbye." And he was about to go. But now she stopped him.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, leave me, Seretse,"
she whispered again.
"That is all I have to say. Leave me, Seretse, till I shall soon be confined. Leave him."
Karenin flushed, and pulling away his hand, left the room. Chapter 5. The famous Petersburg lawyer's waiting room was full when Karenin entered it. Three women, an old lady, a young lady, and a tradesman's wife, and three gentlemen, one a German banker with a ring on his finger, another a bearded merchant, and a third an irate official in uniform with an order hanging from his neck, had evidently long been waiting. Two clerks sat at their tables writing, and the sound of their pens was audible. The writing-table accessories, of which Karenin was a connoisseur, were unusually good, as he could not help noticing. One of the clerks, without rising from his chair, screwed up his eyes and addressed Karenin ill-humouredly.
"What do you want?"
"I want to see the lawyer on business."
"The lawyer is engaged," replied the assistant sternly, and indicated with his pen the persons who were waiting.
"Can he not find time to see me?" said Karenin. "He has no spare time. He is always busy. Be so kind as to wait."
"Then I will trouble you to give him my card," said Karenin with dignity, seeing the impossibility of preserving his incognito.
The assistant took the card, and though he evidently did not approve of what he read on it, went out of the room. Karenin approved in theory of public trial, but for certain high official reasons he did not quite sympathize with some aspects of its application in Russia, and he condemned these applications as far as he could condemn anything that had been confirmed by the Emperor. His whole life had been spent in administrative activity, and therefore when he disapproved of anything, his disapproval was mitigated by a recognition of the inevitability of mistakes and the possibility of improvement in everything. In the new legal institutions, he disapproved of the position occupied by lawyers. But till now, he had never had to deal with a lawyer, and so had disapproved only in theory. Now his disapproval was strengthened by the unpleasant impression he received in the lawyer's waiting room.
"He will be here in a moment," said the assistant. And in fact, a minute or two later, in the doorway appeared the long figure of an elderly jurisconsult who had been conferring with the lawyer, followed by the lawyer himself. The lawyer was a short, thick-set, bald-headed man with a black beard tinged with red, long, light-coloured eyebrows, and a bulging forehead. He was as spruce as a bridegroom, from his white necktie and double watch chain to his patent leather boots. His face was intelligent and peasant-like,
but his dress was dandified and in bad taste. "Come in, please," said the lawyer to Karenin, and gloomily ushering his client in before him, he closed the door. "Won't you take a seat?" He pointed to a chair beside a writing table covered with papers, and himself took the principal seat, rubbing his little hands with their short fingers covered with white hair and bending his head to one side. But hardly had he settled down when a moth flew across the table. The lawyer, with a rapidity one could not have expected of him, separated his hands, caught the moth, and resumed his former position.
"Before I begin speaking of my case," said Karenin, who had followed the lawyer's movements with astonishment, "I must mention that the business about which I have to speak to you must be strictly private."
A scarcely perceptible smile moved the lawyer's drooping, reddish moustache.
"I should not be a lawyer if I could not keep the secrets entrusted to me. But if you would like a confirmation..."
Karenin glanced at him and saw that his intelligent grey eyes were laughing, as if he knew everything in advance.
"You know my name?" continued Karenin. "I know you, and like every Russian, I know..."
"Here he again caught a moth. Your useful activity," said the lawyer, bowing. Karenin sighed, collecting his courage, but having once made up his mind, he went on in his squeaky voice without timidity or hesitation, emphasizing a word here and there.
"I have the misfortune," began Karenin, "to be a deceived husband, and I wish legally to break off relations with my wife, that is, to be divorced, but in such a way that my son should not remain with his mother."
The lawyer's grey eyes tried not to laugh, but they danced with irrepressible glee, and Karenin saw that it was not only the glee of a man getting profitable business, there was triumph and delight, and a gleam resembling the evil boding gleam he had seen in his wife's eyes.
"You want my assistance to obtain a divorce?"
"Just so. But I must warn you that there is a risk that I may be wasting your time. I have come only for a preliminary consultation. I wish for a divorce, but the form in which it can be obtained is of importance to me. It is quite possible that if the forms do not coincide with my requirements, I shall forego my legitimate desire."
"Oh, that is always so," said the lawyer. "That is always open to you."
The lawyer looked down at Karenin's feet, feeling that the sight of his irrepressible joy might offend his client. He glanced at a moth that flew past his nose, and his hand moved, but did not catch it, out of respect for Karenin's situation.
"Although the general outline of our laws relating to this matter is known to me," continued Karenin, "I should like to know the forms in which such cases are conducted in practice."
"You wish me to state," the lawyer said, still not raising his eyes, and adopting with a certain pleasure his client's manner of speech,
"the various methods by which your desire can be carried out?"
And on Karenin's nodding affirmatively, the lawyer continued, only occasionally casting a glance at Karenin's face, which had grown red in patches.
"Divorce under our laws," he said, with a slight shade of disapproval of the laws, "as you are aware, may be granted in the following cases."
"You must wait," he exclaimed, addressing his assistant who had looked in at the door. But he rose all the same, spoke a few words to his assistant, and sat down again.
"In the following cases: physical defect in husband or wife, 5 years' absence without news," and he bent one of his short, hairy fingers, "and in cases of adultery," he uttered the word with evident pleasure, "these are subdivided as follows." And he went on, bending down his thick fingers, though the cases and the subdivisions evidently could not be classed together: physical defects in husband or in wife, and adultery of husband or of wife. As all his fingers had been used, he straightened them all out, and continued, "That is the theoretical view,
but I suppose you've done me the honour of applying to me in order to learn the practical application of the law. Therefore, guided by the precedents, I have to inform you that cases of divorce all come to the following. There is, I suppose, no physical defect or absence without news.
Karenin nodded affirmatively.
Come to the following. Adultery of husband or wife, and the detection of the guilty party by mutual consent, or involuntary detection without such consent. I must add that the latter case is seldom met with in practice.
And with a momentary glance at Karenin, the lawyer became suddenly silent, like a man who, when selling pistols, has described the advantages of the different kinds and waits for his customer's decision. But Karenin remained silent, and so he began again.
The most usual, simple, and reasonable way I consider to be adultery by mutual consent. I should not venture so to express myself were I talking to a man of undeveloped mind, said the lawyer, but I expect it is comprehensible to you.
Karenin was, however, so much upset that he did not at once understand the reasonableness of adultery by mutual consent, and his perplexity was expressed in his looks. But the lawyer immediately helped him.
Two people can no longer live together. There is the fact. And if both agree about that, the details and formalities become unimportant, and at the same time it is the simplest and surest method.
Karenin quite understood now. But he had religious requirements which hindered his acceptance of this method.
It is out of the question in the present case, said he. Only one measure is possible. Involuntary detection confirmed by letters, which I have.
At the mention of letters, the lawyer pressed his lips together and gave vent to a high-pitched sound of pity and contempt.
Please remember that cases of this kind, as you know, are decided by the ecclesiastical department, and the reverend fathers in such cases are keenly interested in the minutest details, he said, with a smile that showed his fellow feeling with the reverend father's taste.
Letters may certainly serve as a partial confirmation, but direct evidence from witnesses must be produced. In general, if you do me the honour to entrust the case to me, leave me to choose the means which should be used. He who desires a result accepts the means of obtaining it.
If it is so, Karenin began, growing suddenly pale.
But at that moment the other suddenly rose and went to the door to speak to his assistant, who had again come to interrupt him.
"Tell her we have not got a cheap sale on here," he said, and came back again.
As he was returning, he furtively caught another moth.
"A fine state my furniture will be in when summer comes," he thought, and frowned. "Yes, you were saying?"
he began.
"I will write and let you know what I decide," said Karenin, rising and holding on by the table.
After a short pause, he said,
"I may conclude from your words that a divorce could be obtained. I would also ask you to let me know your terms."
"It is quite possible, if you allow me full liberty of action," said the lawyer, without taking any notice of the last question. "When may I expect to hear from you?" he added, moving toward the door, his eyes and patent leather boots shining.
"In a week's time. And you will be so good as to let me know whether you are willing to undertake the case, and on what terms?"
"Very well."
The lawyer bowed deferentially, let his client pass out, and being left alone, abandoned himself to his happy mood. He felt so cheerful that, contrary to his custom, he allowed a reduction to the bargaining lady, and gave up catching moths, having made up his mind to have his furniture recovered next winter with velvet, like Sigonin's.
Chapter 6
Karenin had gained a brilliant victory at the committee meeting of the 17th of August, but the consequence of that victory undermined his power. The new committee for investigating the conditions of the subject races from every point of view had been formed and sent to its field of action with unusual promptitude and energy stirred up by Karenin. 3 months later, the committee sent in its report. The subject races' conditions had been investigated from the political, administrative, economic, ethnographical, material, and religious points of view. All the questions had received splendidly drafted answers. Answers not open to doubt, since they were not the result of human thoughts, always liable to error, but were the outcome of official labours. All the answers were based on official data. Reports from governors and bishops, based on reports from district authorities and ecclesiastical superintendents, based in their turn on reports from rural administrative officers and parish priests. Therefore, these answers could not admit of any doubt. All the questions as to why they had bad harvests, for instance, or why the natives kept to their own creeds and so on, questions which, without the convenience of the official machine, don't get solved and can't get solved for centuries, had received clear and certain solutions. And the solutions arrived at were in accord with Karenin's opinions. But Stremov, who had been touched to the quick at the last meeting, made use of tactics for which Karenin was not prepared. Stremov suddenly changed over to Karenin's side, bringing several other members in his train, and not only warmly supported the measures advocated by Karenin, but proposed other, more extreme measures of the same nature. These measures, going beyond Karenin's original idea, were accepted, and then Stremov's tactics became manifest. The measures, carried to extremes, proved so stupid that persons in office, public opinion, intellectual women, and the press, all at the same moment, fell upon them, expressing indignation at the measures themselves and at Karenin, their acknowledged originator. Stremov stood aside, pretending to have blindly followed Karenin's plans, and to be himself indignant now at what had been done, thus undermining Karenin. But in spite of failing health and family troubles, Karenin did not give in. There was a split in the committee. Some of the members, with Stremov at their head, excused their mistake by maintaining that they had put their faith in the report presented by the revisory committee directed by Karenin, and said that that committee's report was nonsense and nothing but waste paper. Karenin and a number of others saw danger in so revolutionary an attitude toward official documents, and continued to support the data presented by the committee. In consequence, the higher circles and even society became quite confused, and, though everybody was deeply interested in the question, no one could make out whether the subject races were really suffering and perishing or were flourishing. Karenin's position, partly in consequence of this, and partly from the contempt that fell on him as a result of his wife's infidelity, became very shaky. In these circumstances, he took an important resolution. He announced, to the surprise of the committee, that he would ask to be allowed to go and investigate the matter himself, and having received permission, he started for the distant provinces. Karenin's departure was much talked about, especially because, just before starting, he formally returned the post fare sufficient to pay for 12 horses all the way to his destination, which had been advanced to him. "I consider it very fine of him," the Princess Betsy said, referring to it in a conversation with Princess Mayakaya. "Why should they pay for post-horses when everybody knows that we now have railways everywhere?" But the Princess Mayakaya did not agree, and was even irritated by Princess Tsverskaya's views. "It is all very well for you to talk, who possess I don't know how many millions," she said, "but I am very glad when my